Hi, welcome to Measured and Metric, a podcast about engineering monuments, the people who built them, and the people who use them. My name is Vivian Yu.
And my name is John Julius.
I'm a civil engineer.
And I'm married to a civil engineer.
Every episode, we're going to pick one engineering monument, maybe it's ancient or maybe it's brand new, from somewhere in the world.
We're going to tell you about what it is, what it does, who built it, and how it was built, but we're not going to touch on why.
We're going to tell you why. That's a very important component in engineering.
Oh, whatever.
So let's get started. Today, we're going to talk about the Panama Canal. So, John, why don't you start by telling us about what you know about the Panama Canal?
Okay, so basically, Panama is the country where the North American and South American continents meet. When you look at it on the map, it's this very skinny little thing. But the problem is that in order to go from the Pacific Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean or vice versa, have to basically go all the way down south of South America and then come back up, or you can go around the other way around, like the long way around the globe. But when you just have this tiny little skinny country that's standing between you and getting to where you want to go, that's a very annoying route. So what they did was they took Panama and they dug a canal.
Yep, that's generally a pretty good description of what the Panama Canal is. So I don't know if in your mind you're thinking that they just carved like a straight line across the country.
It is a straight line across the country.
Right. And that's what I thought too. But what's interesting is that the Panama Canal is actually a system of a lot of different things that allows you to go from one ocean to the other. It's not a clear-cut straight line, kind of like this man-made river that I envisioned before I started researching this.
Right.
So let me give you a description of what this canal system looks like by just taking you on a journey from one ocean to the other.
Okay.
Okay. We're going to start from the Atlantic Ocean. You're going to enter through the Limon Bay with your vessel. And at that point, a pilot is actually going to board your ship.
Okay. A pilot?
Yes.
Pirate.
A pilot.
Okay.
No, not a pirate. A pilot that is basically working for the Panama Canal operators. And this pilot is going to determine the direction and the speed of your vessel as it goes through the canal.
Okay.
You'll pass through the breakwaters that protects the coastline. So these breakwaters are kind of like a seawall that's constructed off in the water. And it breaks down the waves that hit the coastline so that it protects the harbor against erosion.
Right. Okay.
Okay. So you're going to go through that and then you'll enter the first set of locks, the Gatun locks. John, maybe you want to explain a little bit of what locks are?
Yeah. So it's a boat elevator. I know this. I've seen them. I've seen them in real life, actually.
Oh.
It's a boat elevator. So you got this big box thing. And so you've got the high side of your river canal and you've got the low side of your river canal. And you basically drive into this box and then they close the doors and then it'll either fill up with water or else all the water will drain out until it's at the same level as the other side of the river. And then the other side of the box opens and your boat drives out. It's just a big box that fills up or empties.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Yeah. In essence, what it is, the Gatun locks is going to have three of these chambers because it lifts three times.
Okay. So wait, so it's like you get into one box, it lifts you up and then you drive from that box into another box and then it lifts you up.
That's right.
So all you just like three connected boxes.
Yeah. So right. The reason kind of why they do this too is because it preserves the amount of water that you need, because you can imagine you can fill each box up with almost the same amount of water, right?
Right.
So you're reducing the amount of water you're essentially wasting each time.
Okay.
And then there's also just like the hydraulics and the structural integrity of the boxes involved. If you're building just one giant lock, you're building these massive walls on each side. It's got to contain like a lot more water pressure. So all in all, you're going to go through three of these.
Okay, I accept the premise.
It's going to raise your boat up by 26 meters above the sea level of the Atlantic Ocean.
Okay.
So that's pretty significant. And these locks are pretty narrow. So, you know, they didn't want to construct something oversized. Mm-hmm. And they also don't want you to be kind of like ramming your boat into it.
Right.
So essentially what happens is workers are going to come out and hook your boat up to these little automated locomotives that run on rails on either side of these locks.
Okay.
They call them mules. And the mules will basically like pull your boat through each stage of this thing.
Right.
And it takes roughly 8 minutes to get through this whole lock system.
Well, that's pretty good.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
It's pretty fast. And then on the other side, you're going to be in the Gatun Lake.
Right.
So the Gatun Lake is an artificial lake that was made for the purpose of the Panama Canal. What they did was they dammed the Chagres River and flooded a huge area that actually makes up 32 kilometers of this journey. And now the whole Panama Canal is 82 kilometers.
Okay.
So 32 kilometers, that's over a third of your journey going through this man-made lake.
Yeah, which is just it's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's like the first indication that this is not just a straight cut across.
Right. So, but I feel like, oh God, this is dumb. Okay. But you get a man-made lake and you get a natural lake. And once the lake is there, you're not going to know the difference.
Well, right. I mean, it's a lake is a lake. Yeah, it didn't exist there before.
It's real water.
Yeah.
Right. So it's like an artificial. But anyways, that's not exactly relevant to what you're saying. So
it was the largest artificial lake that was made at its time. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's some engineering involved still because they do control the levels of the lake. So this lake feeds all the water that goes into the locks every time it fills up and comes down.
Okay.
And basically the water level is being used to maneuver all these vessels. So it is controlled. Like it's very monitored. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they raise it or they lower it just based on how much water they need to store at any given time and weather patterns as well. Because there's, you know, rainy season and off season. Fresh water from this lake also feeds some of the major cities and towns, including Panama City itself.
Oh, wow. So wait, so this is a freshwater lake.
Mm-hmm.
Separated by three boxes from the ocean.
Yes.
So how do they keep it fresh?
Well, the water doesn't come from the ocean, right? The water comes from the mountains.
Right.
So it's fresh water.
Okay.
Yeah.
Coming down the mountains. Okay.
Yeah. So the water flows out towards the ocean.
Right.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Good?
Yeah, I guess so.
All right. So this lake is, like I said, really big. So there's no direct route that you go through to get to the other side. There's also like little islands that kind of stick out of it. So your route through this lake is actually going to depend on the size of your vessel as well. There are shortcuts if your vessel is, you know, like a speedy little speedboat thing.
Okay.
Or
if it's a tugboat.
Tugboat. Yeah. So you could take a shortcut if it's a tugboat, but right. Not if it's just like a massive freight barge.
Yeah.
Right. It's going to take multiple turns. The route is going to be dependent on your pilot.
Okay.
On the other side, you're going to enter into the Gaillard Cut. So once you've made it through the lake, you enter the Gaillard Cut, which is probably the part that most resembles what I thought the canal would look like. This area was cut through the hillside. It's very straightforward. You can look at pictures online. We'll post some probably.
We will definitely post some.
Yes, we will definitely post some. And it cuts through these hills. And I'm going to tell you later how this was constructed. But for now, just focus on the fact that you're floating through these mountains on both sides of you for the next 12 kilometers.
Okay.
Okay. You're going to enter another set of locks. This time it's going to drop you down. So now you're getting to the home stretch towards the Pacific Ocean.
Right.
So that's the Pedro Miguel Lock. And then you're going to enter into another artificial lake. This one is a lot smaller. And then you'll go through the final set of locks. It'll drop twice until you're at the level of the Pacific Ocean.
Okay.
This one's actually interesting because the level of the Pacific Ocean varies a lot more depending on its tides than the Atlantic Ocean.
Oh.
So that second set of locks is going to drop you wherever the Pacific is at that time of day.
Right. Oh, here's a question. Is that an easy thing to do with a lock?
To determine where the tide is?
Yeah.
You know, I'm not entirely sure. I would imagine so, because it's all dependent on hydraulics. So it's going to drain as much water until it's at the level of the ocean. And then once it's at the level of the ocean, the water's not going to flow out anymore, right?
Right.
Logically speaking, it should be fairly straightforward.
That makes sense.
You're going to go through your last bit of channel towards the Pacific Ocean. You're going to go under the Bridge of the Americas.
Okay.
Now, the name kind of gives this away, but basically when the canal was built, this bridge was the only overland connection between North and South America. So that's why it's called the Bridge of the Americas.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. So basically they went from having it where you could get over land between North and South America, but you couldn't get between the oceans. And then for a little while, they had it where you could get between the oceans, but you couldn't get over land between, mm-hmm. Yeah, right? So
then they had to, they built two things to fix both problems.
Yes.
After you go under the bridge, your pilot is going to disembark. You can say goodbye to your pilot, and then you'll float on down into the Bay of Panama and off you go.
Okay.
Yeah. So you can see that it's not a straightforward path.
No, you've got to do some stuff. You've got to hang out with some lakes that didn't used to exist.
Yeah, it's a bit of a journey. It takes 10 hours, roughly, to go through.
Okay.
Some of the larger barges sometimes choose to just drop their anchors and stay overnight in the lake, like the bigger lake.
Who can blame them?
Yeah, I mean, it's probably scenic. So, no, I think if they just couldn't do it in one day, they'd rather not travel at night.
Yeah, that makes sense. Is.
So, yes, this is the Panama Canal. It was completed in 1914, and it cost a total of $500 million American dollars at its time, which converts to $9.2 billion today.
Okay. So, quite pricey.
It was not cheap.
Right.
Right. But there is a very good amount of history that supports why this justified the cost. So we're going to talk about the history next.
Excellent.
All right. So we're going to go way back and talk about why this is an important route, okay?
Okay. So how far back?
We're going to go back to 1534.
1534 Common Era?
1534 AD, yes.
Okay, CE.
Okay, I'm going to preface this with, I'm sorry that we're starting with like Western history when the West discovered Panama. I recognize fully that this was probably an important route before white men found Panama.
Yes.
We don't have any history of what the indigenous people thought about connecting the two oceans. So I can't really speak to that. But what's recorded in Western history is that Charles V, who was the Roman Emperor, Holy Roman Emperor, and also the King of Spain at the time.
So had two jobs.
Two jobs, yeah. Wanted to find a way for ships to go through the Americas because he was the King of Spain and he was also the king of the colony of Peru.
Okay.
And the idea was that if he could get closer to bringing his supplies and his troops to Peru, it would give him an advantage over the Portuguese.
Right.
But he never really did anything with it. It was just, this would be nice to have.
I mean, Portugal is completely surrounded by Spain, right?
Yeah.
And so if he wanted to beat the Portuguese, why wouldn't he just take Spain and then just like swallow Portugal?
I mean, European history goes way further back, right? There's if the Spanish wanted to really just like engulf Portugal, I think it was a lot more complicated than just like geographically surrounding them.
Right.
But this was the New World where anything was possible and land was up for grabs by the Western world that didn't quite care about who was already there.
Okay.
So the Portuguese, by virtue of dear old Christopher Columbus.
Yes.
And subsequent settlers, they've already formed a colony on the east side of South America. Mm-hmm. And Spain were a little bit late to the party, so they were on the west side.
Okay, but so then they had to land on the east side and trek all the way across the mountains, across all of the jungle and all that stuff, just to get to the west side where they could set up their flags and say that this is ours.
Right.
And all of these people didn't do anything. This is ours.
Yeah.
Good. Okay.
Right. That was the very first record of when they thought this would be a good idea. Next up, we're moving to the late 1690s, where the Kingdom of Scotland decided to establish a colony in Panama. And the idea was they wanted to have a piece of this pie in the New World. But I mean, late 1690s, like, they were pretty late to the party.
Right, yeah.
A lot of land has already been claimed by the British, the French, the Spanish, the Portuguese. So they thought that maybe rather than controlling land, they would control trade.
Okay.
So they wanted to establish a colony, and by establishing a colony there, then facilitate the trade between the two oceans. And it would be basically an overland route where they would, I guess, tax the goods that would flow back and forth.
Yeah. I mean, it is very intimidating. You have a huge Scotsman asking you for money and, you know, picking up your bags and carrying them for you, right?
That's, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I'll go with that. Yeah.
I would pay up.
But it was kind of poorly planned. It had a lot of bad leadership, and they kind of didn't anticipate the tropical climate or the disease that comes with the tropical climate. So you can imagine your big Scotsman just coming down with all sorts of malaria.
Oh, not to mention the sunburns. Yeah.
Real unfortunate. Yeah. And the Spanish weren't super thrilled that there's now another new player in the game. So they were attacking them. And then the British, of course, weren't super thrilled that the Scots were doing anything.
Yeah.
And so they kind of sabotaged them.
Oh.
So in the end, the whole thing was a disaster. It was a major flop. Most of the Scottish aristocracy had put money into this, and they were basically bankrupt.
Okay.
And this essentially led to Scotland joining England to form Great Britain.
Okay, so all of the everything, all of the angst and everything that we're still seeing today came about largely because the Scottish failed to build the Panama Canal, is what you're saying.
Well, no, I'm not saying that exactly, but this was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back.
Wow.
And the Scottish aristocracy and kind of the ruling class realized that they weren't going to succeed in this new world without the British.
That, yeah, that is a hard pill to swallow.
Yeah. So you can imagine, like, this route has already led to some pretty big flops.
Yes.
The trend is going to continue for a little bit longer.
Good. I love watching white men fail.
I'm not going to support that. I mean, history is a complicated thing.
Yeah, I like watching white people succeed too, but there's just, you know, we got to fail once in a while.
You know what? Colonization is a very complicated and bad history, man. That was just not a great time.
It is real ugly.
Okay. So next, in 1788, Thomas Jefferson also suggested to France, because he was a minister to France, that they should build a canal. So he was really the first guy to, like, plant a little seed in the French government's mind that, hey, a canal would be nice here.
Right. And so this is the Thomas Jefferson or a Thomas Jefferson?
This is the Thomas Jefferson.
Okay.
Yeah. The American Thomas Jefferson. I'm sorry, we're Canadians. I don't actually know anything about Thomas Jefferson.
No,
he's like a really famous American.
I know that he's on one of the American bills. Or coins. He's on something. He's there.
Yeah.
Yeah. You hear his name.
Okay. So yeah, it's that Thomas Jefferson.
Okay.
Okay. And then in 1848, there was the gold rush in California. So remember, California is on the other side of North America from Europe. So of course, they wanted to ship that stuff over to the other ocean. Shortly after, in 1855, the Americans built the Panama Railroad.
Right.
Now, this was to help them ship things from one ocean to the other. It's an overland route. It wasn't the best solution, but it definitely worked for a while. And the route of this railroad actually determined much of the route and the alignment of the canal itself.
Okay.
So this railroad, it's going to come back up. It's very instrumental in the construction of this canal.
Right. Little foreshadowing.
A little. There you go. All right. So 1881, almost 100 years after Thomas Jefferson's suggestion, the French finally started to construct the Panama Canal.
Okay. So good time.
Yeah. You know, things moved slowly back then.
Yeah.
So what really kind of gave them the boost to say, we can do this, was the Suez Canal that they successfully built.
Okay.
It was a project that connected the Mediterranean Sea and the Red Sea.
Right. Okay. And so this was where?
It's kind of on the northeast corner of Egypt.
Okay. So I knew that, but maybe not all the listeners knew that.
Yeah. Okay. I knew that you knew that.
Yeah. I definitely knew that. And so Egypt is where?
Is like kind of on the northeast corner of Africa.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Geography lesson over. Okay. So the French just built the Suez Canal and they thought, well, what the heck? Let's just keep going.
Right.
What's next?
Yeah.
And they thought Panama Canal, well, this is going to be a piece of cake. It's only 40% as long as the Suez Canal.
Right.
Right. And Suez Canal was more than twice as long and we built that. So this is going to be a piece of cake.
Yeah.
Right. Not kind of understanding that, you know, the Panama region is very different from Northeast Egypt.
Right.
That there's a tropical climate there, that there's mosquitoes and malaria there, that there's a crazy river, that floods. And
Egypt kind of has another crazy river.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a very different environment that they weren't expecting.
Right.
So really, without thinking too much about it, they sent the same guy that built the Suez Canal to go build the Panama Canal.
He had a good resume.
Yeah, sure. I mean, that makes sense. That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Okay, so Ferdinand de Lesseps is the guy.
Okay.
Just finished the Suez Canal, freshly imported into the Panama Canal. He didn't visit Panama during rainy season, so kind of like the roughest time.
Yeah.
He just visited during the high tourist season.
Of course.
You know, as we all do.
I've never been to Panama in rainy season either, so I can't judge.
He basically took the same design concepts from the Suez and tried to apply it to Panama.
Okay.
Now, the Suez Canal was a sea level canal. It basically was they dug a channel from one sea to the other.
Yeah.
Exactly what we said was not the case for Panama.
Right. So basically, yeah. Okay. So that's good. So this guy did really well in one context, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And like, sure, you got to start somewhere, right?
Sure.
He started excavating. Now, earlier when we were going through the canal together, we went up and over, right? There was a significant raise in sea level.
Yeah.
So imagine that if there wasn't that raise, then that would mean instead of a large artificial lake that you flooded, you would have had to just dig that entire length.
Sure.
So he started.
Oh, no.
It kept being repeated. He had to repeat his work a lot because of the landslides that he didn't quite expect.
Yeah.
The landslides of the geography because of the rainy season, the soil condition that he didn't really encounter in the desert climate of Egypt. So there was a lot of frustration there.
Yeah. I mean, early engineering, right?
Sure.
Dirt is dirt and sand is dirt and just dig it away, right?
It didn't quite work. He also didn't anticipate the jungle conditions. So the venomous snakes, the venomous spiders, malaria, yellow fever, tropical diseases. So like a few years into construction, the death count was about 200 workers per month.
That is unbelievable.
That is not going to pass any health and safety tests at this point.
No. And so now these workers, I'm assuming some of them were probably brought over from France, but I'm guessing it was a lot of local indigenous workers who were not given appropriate...
Yes, there were a lot of workers that were actually recruited from the West Indies. So from Jamaica, from the Caribbean area, a lot of former slaves and slave descendants.
Right.
It was not great. Like the conditions were not great. Obviously, the pay was not great. It was a very difficult working condition. Yeah. And obviously with very high risk.
Right. But I mean, think about how much money the French would have made if they had, you know, actually finished it, right?
Sure. Yeah.
There's economics. There's an upside. 101. Yeah.
So at some point, De Lesseps realized that, okay, we can't just dig this out like we did with the Suez. We're going to need to pivot. And so he changed his design to include a dam that would raise the canal level, right? So he's getting closer. And to build this dam, he recruited Gustav Eiffel.
And now is this an Eiffel or the Eiffel?
This is the Eiffel.
Wow.
That's right. So Gustav Eiffel had just finished building the Eiffel Tower.
Okay. So another good resume.
Right. We got a lot of, good pedigree here.
Yeah.
So Gustav Eiffel was contracted to design and build the lock and dam. And he started working on it in 1887. But within a year, he stopped getting any payments. So it was kind of like the writing was on the wall.
Right.
The company that was formed to build the canal was bankrupt by 1889. So this is about 8 years into construction.
Okay.
They had spent $287 million American, which is the equivalent of $7.8 billion today.
Okay.
So that's a pretty good amount of sunk cost.
Yeah.
And by this point, an estimated 22,000 men had died.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah, so most of them were Jamaicans or from other parts of the West Indies.
Right.
A lot of investors lost their savings. There was a lot of outrage in just France in general.
Right.
All the people that aren't going to recoup the cost of this canal.
Of course.
And a lot of people who were suspected of misappropriation of funds or raising money under false pretenses were charged.
Wow. That is just... altogether, a pretty massive failure.
Like most engineering failures, it ended with lawsuits.
Right.
So, and Gustav Eiffel himself was actually charged, but he was later acquitted. But it really damaged his reputation. He didn't really go back into construction after that.
Yeah.
So
I also find it telling that people were charged with fraud and misappropriation of funds, but nobody was necessarily charged with murder.
Right. Right. That's just another very good point.
Yeah. The economic implications of the new world.
It was not a great time. So ultimately, they kind of did what they could to clean up the mess and they sold the whole thing to the United States in 1904 for $40 million.
Okay. And they had sunk $292 million?
$287. They tried to sell it for $100 million, actually.
Okay.
And what happened was the Americans were exploring a different route through Nicaragua.
Right.
Instead, Nicaragua is not as skinny as Panama, but it had a natural lake in the center, so they would have dug two canals instead.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it was a viable route. And when the Americans were like, $100 million sounds a bit steep. I don't know about that. And so they were like, no, never mind. How about 40?
Right.
So what they sold was all the equipment, all the work that was done so far.
Right.
And the Panama Railroad and basically just the rights to construct there.
Okay.
Yeah. And at this point, Panama didn't really exist. At this point, we're still kind of looking at like a colonial jurisdiction.
Right.
So the United States gave Colombia $25 million to recognize Panama that it sort of established as its own state.
Okay.
So there's this whole kind of like geopolitical sphere that the Americans had to set up just so they could build this canal.
Right.
So 1904, the Americans have inherited a bit of a mess from the French.
purchased a bit of a mess from the French.
For a good deal. Yeah. For a good deal. They set up a commission, the Isthmian Canal Commission, the ICC, basically to oversee construction and make sure that they don't make the same mistakes.
Right.
Which is great. That's important. In 1904, Theodore Roosevelt appointed John Findlay Wallace as the chief engineer. Wallace did not last. He was pretty overwhelmed by the diseases and, you know, he looked at the French infrastructure and all the equipment that he inherited and he said, this is garbage.
Right.
So within a year, he had quit.
Okay.
Yeah. It's like, I don't want to deal with this. But this is where the hero of our story enters.
Okay. The white hero of our story.
Yes. Thanks for pointing that out. Yes.
I know.
So John Frank Stevens, he was a self-educated engineer who built the Great Northern Railroad, which is basically a railroad that connected the Americas
right.
on the north side. I think it went from like Illinois to Seattle or Washington somewhere.
Okay. Kind of. That's a pretty good.
Yeah.
It's a pretty good route. And also, I just want to say a self-educated engineer. You do not have those anymore, do you?
No. Engineering is a very regulated profession at this point. There is a great deal of education requirements that you need to meet, plus a training period, apprenticeship period. So
yeah.
No, that self-educated is not a thing anymore. But yeah. He was a self-educated engineer. He did have some amount of education, but for the most part, he kind of figured things out as he went.
Right. Okay. So again, exactly the kind of person that you want to put in charge of workers' lives.
Yeah. I mean, they had guys with great pedigree beforehand and they didn't do anything. So why not give it to this guy?
Okay. Just give it a shot.
So he used his experience as a railroad engineer to handle canal building because, you know, linear infrastructure is linear infrastructure.
It all just goes in a straight line, yeah. Except in this case where it doesn't.
One's a train, one's a ship.
It's just a boat.
But one of the things that he recognized and he really took away with building the railroad was he recognized that the workers were important and you couldn't just have them dropping like flies.
Right.
So the first thing he did was rebuild the housing, the cafeterias, the hotels, the water systems, the repair shops, the warehouses, the hospitals, the schools, the churches, basically anything that would be needed to support this, like basically a small town that was going to be building this.
Okay, so that's some genuinely good news.
Yeah. And he basically said, and I quote, "The digging is the least thing of all."
Okay, it's kind of a catchy little.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was significant. I mean, it's not exactly an engineering design, but for this guy to recognize the components that need to come together for engineering to succeed, like that is a very broad and like big picture thinking that a good engineer requires.
Yeah. So you got to take a holistic view.
Yeah. He also reestablished and expanded the Panama Railway to transport all the material that he would need into the area and transport all of the excavated material out of the area.
Okay.
So yeah, he got the logistics figured out.
Yeah.
Which is really important. That was a big thing that the French didn't do.
Right. And it sounds like he made good use of the train.
He did.
That was already there.
Yeah, he just expanded it. He, I think, double tracked it so that you could have bidirectional movement.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah.
Clever.
He also put in charge a very important chief sanitation officer, William C. Gorges, who just threw mosquito nets and insecticides everywhere. He established a much more modern water and sewage system so that within 2 years, mosquito spread diseases were nearly eliminated.
Well, that's actually quite impressive.
Yeah. So it's really recognizing that it takes a village.
Yes.
It really does. Now, sidebar, this doesn't mean that the conditions were good for the workers. They just weren't dying.
Right.
Right. So we've already gone through, the Americans did exactly the same thing. It was a lot of people coming in from the West Indies, trying to make a quick buck. You know, there were a lot of rumors and stories that, oh, if you just work a few years on the canal, you can make enough money to come back and live like a rich man.
Okay.
So, you know, rich by West Indies standards, but a lot of the people, especially the black men and women, were not getting paid nearly the same amount as the white laborers.
Yeah.
And it was a lot of injustice, for right. sure.
Yeah.
So, yes, living conditions improved, but in general, there was still a lot of inequality.
Yeah.
Just want to get that in because, you know, we're talking about these great white heroes that built these engineering monuments, but definitely there's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears and just general sacrifice that people of color had to make as yeah. well.
Of course. Keeping in mind as well that this is fundamentally economic infrastructure. Right? Mm-hmm. Like the primary purpose of this is for trade and for commerce.
Yeah. The people of Panama are not going to see the benefits of this for quite some time after it's done.
Yeah.
And certainly the people of the West Indies that worked on this, I mean, they profited some amount as workers, but definitely their contributions are very much overlooked.
Right.
So the engineering panel of the U.S., was established to kind of review some design options. They started with recommending a sea level canal again. Let's just brute force dig our way through this place.
Yeah, yeah.
It didn't work before, but maybe it'll work now.
Good old American ingenuity.
John Frank Stevens, our self-educated engineer, saw what the area looked like in full flood. So he took his job very seriously. He actually right. visited during rainy season. Okay. And he said, there's not a chance this is going to work. Right. You guys, like, we got to flood this place. And he was able to convince President Roosevelt of this. Mm-hmm. So by this point, you can see that he really won the trust of the president.
Right.
He was sanctioned to upgrade all the old French equipment. He got new steam-powered cranes and rock crushers, drills. A lot of the equipment was actually mounted on the railroad. So you can see why the railroad itself was still very important.
Yep.
This guy was a little bit of a one-track mind.
Yeah. Apparently a double-track mind.
You know what works, works.
Yeah.
And so he also had to kind of reroute the railroad because the flooding of Gatun Lake was going to flood parts of the railroad itself. So right. he had to rebuild that. So there was a lot of logistics and setup that he had to do before he could actually get to the canal itself.
Right.
By 1907, Stevens actually resigned quite suddenly.
Okay.
Apparently, President Roosevelt was pretty annoyed.
Yeah.
Just not too pleased. Yeah. But nobody really knows why he resigned. It might have been that at this point, he has set up all the logistics. He had actually set up the railroad. He had set up the people. And the last thing that was left to do was dig out the rest of the canal and build a dam, which were both things that he did not really know how to do.
Okay.
So he might have resigned because he knew that it was either not his expertise or didn't interest him.
Yeah. It's like that episode of Seinfeld when George has to like leave on a high note because if he sticks around too long, then everybody knows that he's not funny.
I guess so. I guess yeah. so. So George Washington Goethals was appointed as chief engineer.
Okay. And so this is not the George Washington. This is a George Washington.
Correct. This is a George Washington Goethals. And the project was transported to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. So for the next 2 years, they finished it up and it was completed in 1914, okay. 2 years ahead of schedule.
Wow.
That never happens anymore. They finished building the dams and the locks, the breakwaters, and the Guyard Cut. So the cut was the last part. This was the part that went through the hillside. And on October 10th, 1913, President Woodrow Wilson.
Okay, so different president now.
Yeah, he gets to take credit for this. It's
yeah, that's great.
I know. President Wilson sent a telegraph to signal the detonation that would destroy the last dike and flood the Guyard Cut, finally joining the two oceans.
Right. And so we got to send a telegraph, which at the time would have been
sort of a big deal.
Sort of a big deal.
To detonate a thing. It feels like one of those, you know, long-winded, like, animation where, you know, the ball goes down.
Yeah,
the
Rube Goldberg machine.
Yeah, and it hits a thing and then hits another thing. And then it ultimately just, like, all it does is, like, push a button.
Yeah, and so here's a question that may not have been recorded in the annals of history. When he sent that telegram, did that trigger the detonation, or did that just tell somebody on the other end to do the detonation?
So the research says it signaled the detonation. So I don't think it actually triggered it.
Right.
I'm not entirely sure.
Although
it might have. I mean, the signal is part of it. I mean, we're getting off track here.
Yeah. Let's just pretend that he sent a telegraph and it lit a fuse.
It lit a fuse. It went down a ramp.
Hit and then
a pair of scissors that cut a thing and... Well, no, I'm...
It's as cool as you want it to be, if you just imagine.
That's right. Okay, so it was opened in 1913.
Okay.
It was under American sovereignty for many, many years. And basically, the Americans got to operate it, got to take all the revenue for it, for all the ships and trade that would go through it. And the people of Panama... They were not too happy about this, obviously, going through their land.
Yeah.
There were a lot of protests, especially after the Suez Canal was nationalized in Egypt.
Right.
They kind of said, well, this should be ours. And Panama didn't actually assume full control of the canal until December 31st, 1999. So until basically 2000.
Yeah.
Which is pretty recent history if you think about it.
I mean, we were both alive.
Yeah. This is part of colonial history. You can think about it.
Absolutely.
And that's very recent. So anyway, that is the history of how we got the Panama Canal.
Okay. Well, we had some pretty sad moments in there, but they got it done in the end and got to make a lot of money off of it.
And still do.
And still do to this day.
So next, I want to tell you a bit about the science behind how they built things, some of the innovations that they introduced, and some of the challenges that they met.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, so there were basically two main problems that the engineers had to overcome to build the Panama Canal. The first one was the Chagres River. And this river came from the northeast highlands of Panama and flowed towards the Atlantic.
Okay.
And this is like your earlier question about where did the water for the lake come from? It came from the Chagres River. It came from the highlands.
Okay.
And this river had tremendous flow and a lot of variation in flow rates. So depending on what season it was, it could be very turbulent. It was very destructive, basically. Right. And a lot of the early work that they did would be undone depending on what happened with the river.
Of course.
In order to control this river... That's where they got the idea of building the lake.
Right.
So the Gatun Dam was constructed to build this lake, and the lake had to be this big so that it could actually absorb the variation in the river flow.
Okay.
Right. So it couldn't have been a small lake.
Yeah. It had to be pretty massive because it's got a big river.
Yes.
And a temperamental river.
That's right.
Right.
And it, like I said, provides the water to operate the locks. The lake itself changed the landscape and the face of this entire area. It created new ecosystems for the animals in the area and also for the indigenous people of the area.
Right.
So this really was a major change. So that was how they controlled the Chagres River. The second problem was the Gaillard Cut. Now, this was the section that went through the hillside. They basically just tried to cut straight through it, and it caused a lot of landslides because the soil was very unstable. You can imagine this wet area. The soil is, you know, it goes through these wet and dry cycles. It's loose. It's going to cause landslides. there's this idea that somehow the rock would be stable if they cut very steeply, and it wasn't.
Of course.
So there was a board of consulting engineers that suggested cutting the slope at 1.5 to 1.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that doesn't mean anything to you, but if you can think about it, our typical construction methods now, you wouldn't usually cut very deep at a 2-to-1 slope. If you're cutting 2-to-1, you don't want to go more than like a meter and a half in height. Okay. Yeah. They wanted to go 73 meters in height at basically like a 45 degree angle.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Well, they must have been self-educated as well.
So, board of
consulting self-educated engineers.
We would not do this now. So in practice, the rocks began to collapse at a height of only 20 meters.
Okay.
Right? And it was clay in the area that they wanted to dig. Nice. So it was unstable. They had basically built this last. So at this point, the river had been dammed, right? Water had been backing up.
Okay.
The clay had become filled with water, which made it into this soupy mess.
Yeah.
And it completely compromised the stability of the soil, not just in the canal, but also like under these mountains.
Okay.
So what happened was every day they would dig the canal. But the weight of the mountains on either side would push the soil down and back into the canal.
Nice.
At first, unknowingly, they were basically leveling the hills from the bottom up.
Right.
And eventually they realized that, the strata wasn't strong enough to support these mountains anymore.
Right.
So they had to cut back these mountains on both sides. They have to really dig real fast. And to this day, like, dredging is still a big part of the maintenance of the canal in this area.
Right.
They basically had to level the mountains to the point where it wasn't so heavy that it was pushing the dirt back in.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, hey, you could say that they moved a mountain.
They did.
I wouldn't, but you could make that argument.
They weren't trying to, certainly.
Yeah.
But imagine if they didn't go with the higher water level canal. Like, if they had to dig 26 meters even deeper.
Yeah.
Through these mountains.
Yeah. Pretty horrible.
I can't imagine what they would have done at that point.
I mean, they might have just never done it. And the world would probably look pretty different.
That is the Gaillard Cut. And that's why, kind of, you're going through this area through the hillside, and it's fairly unassuming. It's exactly what you would imagine the rest of the canal looking like, right? Sure. It's a man-made channel, but this was the toughest, hardest portion to construct.
Yeah. To be fair, I mean, you're trying to dig a straight line through a clay mountain, so I'm not exactly surprised that this is the hardest part.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so those were kind of some of the engineering challenges on top of the other ones we've already talked about, you know, the logistics, the equipment, all of that.
Right.
Today, there is a lot that goes through the Panama Canal.
Okay.
Now, 13,548 ships went through in 2017. So that's the annual traffic count.
Yeah.
It basically moves 200 million metric tons of cargo in 1 year.
Okay.
So that might not mean a lot to you, but that's basically moving 40 Great Pyramids.
Okay. Or one Great Pyramid 40 times.
Sure. Yeah, just ship it back and forth.
Ship it back and forth.
It's pretty significant. The oil that was being produced in California at the time when this was constructed, the lumber that was being produced in the Northwest Coast, all of this immediately contributed to the trade in the area. So there was significant demand for this.
Yeah,
it was also considered a military advantage. So this was finished in 1913, so right in time for the First World War.
Yeah.
Right? The Navy was able to just kind of move back and forth between the two oceans fairly easily.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So the impact of this was immediately felt, and it just continues. It's being expanded. It's been expanded several times already. There were additional locks added in 2016 so that you could actually maintain the old ones, which at this point are 100 years old now, right?
Yeah.
So they they need to be maintained without really cutting into the operations.
Right. Okay. So build some redundant locks. That's a good idea.
Mm-hmm. It's tolled. Obviously, you need to pay a toll.
Okay. Have to pay a toll to go through.
Yes. So okay. The toll is based on the cargo and the weight of the cargo that you're bringing.
Right.
Generally, the revenue of it is $2 billion a year.
US?
Yes.
$2 billion US dollars. That's like 2.8 billion Canadian right now.
That's roughly, yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because this canal still continues to be so important, but being the only one is kind of pushing it to capacity. So there's been other projects that have been proposed to capitalize on this demand. So I mentioned before that the Americans were looking at the Nicaragua Canal option. This was actually approved in 2013 by the Nicaragua government, where they gave a concession, a 50-year concession period to a Hong Kong company to design, build, and operate.
Right.
But nothing happened. Like,
okay.
I don't know what they did with the money. I don't know if they just ran with it. I don't know. But basically, it just went defunct.
Right. That's a shame.
Yeah, but it is definitely a viable option and it keeps coming back up. So maybe eventually. There's been dry canal options, which is basically just like a port and a rail in between. It's they call it the dry canal. It's not a canal. There's been trade options talked about in Guatemala and Costa Rica and El Salvador / Honduras, but nothing has really come to fruition. The next most viable option is actually the Northwest Passage, because with the polar ice caps melting due to climate change, it's opened up another route to connect the oceans.
Pretty crazy.
Yeah. But it's not ideal, right? Like, that's a landscape that changes all the time. And it's its own harsh climate. And how do you really, like, control?
You'd have to have a special boat all the time.
Yeah. Right,
that can like break through the ice just if it happens. Yeah, it's not a reliable. I get it. I gotcha.
So yeah, that's basically all the things that could potentially compete with the Panama Canal. But until any of them really come to existence, the Panama Canal is what we have. And that's more or less it. You know, like, this is a significant work that was constructed about 100 years ago.
Yeah.
And it continues to be a major player today.
Yeah.
It is definitely an engineering monument.
Right.
Definitely a mega project.
Okay. So one quick question.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to touch on how the Panama Canal is completely obsolete ever since we invented the airplane?
No. The movement of cargo by airplane is pretty expensive.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I mean, as we've touched on, the movement of cargo through the Panama Canal is also pretty expensive.
There's obviously cargo being shipped by airplane, but you're paying for a toll at the airports as well,
right?
And then you're paying for the gas for the airplanes. Like, it.
Yeah, that's true.
Ship cargo. How do I say this? Like, shipping by ships is still usually the most economic option.
Right. Water freight.
Yes, that's right. Oh, some interesting things about the Gatun Lake that I didn't mention. It's a natural habitat that is protected now.
Okay.
Because it is considered part of the canal.
Yeah.
And so the rainforest that surrounds the Gatun Lake is a protected area and some of the best undisturbed natural habitat. It's really interesting because the largest island within this lake is actually established as a Smithsonian study area.
Interesting.
So there's a lot of scientific and biological discoveries that have been made there. And there's a lot of fishing and ecotourism in the area. So I guess one upside of the Panama Canal that's not just purely economical is that it's an interesting eco area that's been protected.
Yeah. That's true. And, you know, it's already economically viable, so they're justified to protect it.
Yeah. I mean, they're incentivized to protect it. So,
yeah. Oh, God. I swear I'm not always this cynical in real life.
No, it's really great because, as we all know, the rainforests all over the world are being cut down. But in this area in particular, it's actually in their interest to keep lumber and all of that away from this area because it protects the integrity of the lake. The plantation around it keeps it from eroding, yeah. keeps it from being damaged during heavy rainstorms or flood events. So it's a natural protection for the canal itself.
Interesting.
Yeah. And obviously it houses a lot of natural flora and fauna.
Yeah. Not to mention all of the cool boats that spend the night.
Yeah, that's right. Great place for boats.
Great place for boats.
So I hope you've learned something interesting about the canal. And
I've learned some things about the canal.
Did this make you feel like you might want to visit it one day?
So I feel like the Panama Canal, I have been to Central America and I loved it. Specifically, the Panama Canal to me is just like an economic infrastructure, right? Like for me, I feel with what I know now, going to the Panama Canal would be the same as, like, I don't know, going to the Empire State built. Like it's a monument to commerce in a lot of ways. But that said, I have not looked at any pictures.
Okay. We'll definitely be posting some pictures on our social media. So
which is
at Measured in Metric on Instagram and at Measured in Met on Twitter.
Nice.
And you can search Measured in Metric on Facebook. I hope you enjoyed this episode, our inaugural initial episode. I hope you subscribe and I hope you leave us a rating and let us know how we're doing and if there's anything else that you'd like to learn about in the future, connect with us. That's it for us. And always remember to measure in metric.